This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Now I know I'm not a winner, and I'll probably never be, but I don't want to live my whole life living in urban poverty. And I'll stand in the welfare line, and I'll eat in the soup kitchen. And if I never get a job, oh, I'll have to live creatively. If I want to see the most beautiful arts, and I'll shake that artist's hand and ask him.
Welcome to the AJ Podcast. I'm your host, Emily Slostra, the Associate Web Editor at Alternatives Journal. This edition of the podcast is on art and media to go along with our latest edition of the magazine. You can listen online to previous podcasts at alternativesjournal.ca/podcasts. This edition features two interviews by Darren Kaster, our friend from the Green Majority. First up, he talks to author Giles Slade. We have an excerpt of Slade's new book, The Big Disconnect, in the latest issue of the magazine. The Big Disconnect is on how our long affair with ever-new technologies has undermined interpersonal relationships. In this interview, Giles talks about how he's lived in 6 countries and has decided that our way of living is incredibly problematic. He talks to Darren about how we throw out material goods and do the same with people. Then we have an interview, also by Darren, with Frankie James, who is a democratic citizen and artist. Frankie talks about her experience having had her tour funding pulled, being told that the Canadian government didn't like her work, and how all of that inspired her new book, Band on the Hill. We have an excerpt of that book in the latest issue of the magazine, and it's called Frankie James Is Your Fault? You can learn more about Giles and Frankie at their websites, gilesslade.com and frankiejames.com. Throughout the podcast, we have music by Richard Garvey and Janice Lee, both Kitchener-Waterloo musicians. To hear more from these musicians, visit richardgarvey.ca and janicejolee.ca. That's Janice, J-O-L-E-E.ca. In the next month or so, you can catch Richard Garvey around Southern Ontario and Janice Lee out west. Here's Richard Garvey with then Starving Artist. Child who
draws chalk on the sidewalk, never puts a hat on, says all art should be free. Meet a hippie singer with torn jeans and broke guitar. He'll say, pay what you can. Oh, I don't want to starve. Then try and see the most beautiful arts was made by starving artist hands. Never waited for a break to starve.
One of the things that was the biggest theme of sort of all of your work is that, I haven't seen you described this way, but I would put you very much as a social critic. Would you disagree with that assessment?
I guess not. I started writing these because I wondered, how we'd got into this mess, and I didn't really even have a very concrete way to describe the mess. I was trying to describe the mess as I was trying to sort of explain it historically, and so, yeah, it's become social criticism, and at least in one dimension, and that's I guess the reason for either my limited popularity or my massive unpopularity. I'm not trying to write Jeremy ads or anything like that, but I think we've invented this terrible way of living, and compared to other cultures that I've lived in, I've lived in 6 countries. We've sort of painted ourselves into a corner, and so I want to know, how we did that, what precisely, the corner is all about, and how to get out of it.
So your most recent book, The Big Disconnect, talks a lot about the social disconnect of, among other things, among many things. You talk a lot about music and the invention of the gramophone and just even the concept of portable music. You also get into a more recent modern day developments, things like Facebook and Twitter and all these sorts of things. Can you just describe quickly just the effect that what actually has happened? What has happened to society and to interpersonal relationships due to Facebook? I kind of understand. I'm not quite as clear on where the gramophone comes in, if you want to just explain that.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's just a very specific example of how we have invented and used technology to support support and encourage our social isolation, there's this broad sort of historical curve from, you know, maybe the 1830s, 1850s onwards, where cities increased in size. More and more people moved into cities from the country and of course, from other countries. And as this was happening, we invented technologies to sustain the connection that we once had with the families that we left in our countries or in the old countries. And so photographs, telephone calls, gramophone records, which were originally used to send messages, all came up, you know, in a very close period of time in the maybe 1860s, 1870s. And so technology became a way to divert ourselves from our loneliness. And as our increasing invention of these kinds of technologies took hold, and as we became acclimatized to them, we began to use them increasingly to divert ourselves both from the feelings of loneliness and isolation that we experienced in the new environment of the city, and also to prevent ourselves from making new connections because these diversions became increasingly good, satisfying, and powerful. And so, you know, when you walk across the urban grid listening to your iPhone or your iPad listening to music, you're getting the same biochemical sort of hit that you get from joining a choir or making music in a group of human beings. But your social skills and your social network is not reinforced by them. So it's kind of like a pacifier. You know, it does what a nipple does, but it's not nearly as satisfying.
When I was thinking about music and connections to people and interrelatedness, something that I like to do and something that people that I know like to do is go out and, for instance, well, once in a while do karaoke. But karaoke is something where you'll find that there's always one or two that are super keen, and then a whole bunch of other people get dragged along because that's what's going on. And then there's a couple of people that, you know, whether they end up there or not, you know, absolutely will not. You know, it seems to be among the list of the top 10, you know, kind of social phobias is being forced to sing in public. But it, you know, it occurs to me from reading from some of the stuff that you're here that this is a very new development. This is something that was very intrinsically part of our social culture until very, very recently.
There was you know, there was a lot more bad music in the old days, but you know, it was prevalent. It was one of the things that we did to divert ourselves. There wasn't any TV, you know. People sat around and told stories, or you know, played board games, or you know, made music with simple musical instruments, fiddles and mouth organs and, you know, washboard basses and stuff like that, guitars. And, you know, maybe the standard wasn't nearly as high as your average indie band, but, you know, it was something that maybe as many as 70%, 80% of people participated in some way, and many evenings a week. And so it was a vehicle for social connection. And also, there's the biochemical aspect of it. When you create music with another person, the trust hormone oxytocin is released, and you bond with them in a very close way, which is something that doesn't happen with you know, pre-recorded music, because of course you're listening to it alone.
I'm wondering about how, when people go to use these sorts of technologies, let's move more kind of back up to the present time now, and we're talking about things like Facebook and Twitter and that sort of idea. Uh-huh. When you, for instance, when you sign up for the now more or less defunct website, for instance, MySpace, for instance, you would immediately get a friend request from this gentleman named Tom, who's the creator of this site, and it seems to be on its face very... They aren't being disguised. I guess what I'm trying to say is they aren't being disguised as actual taking the place of actual relationships. They don't appear to attempt to be replacing them, but they essentially have. Why do you think that interrelationships that are clearly not the same as the types of relationships you'd have with someone in purpose in that you actually knew, like a friend? How do you think this sort of obviously fake sort of social network has so successfully replaced actual relationships?
There's a whole bunch of things going on. There are less opportunities to meet people in meaningful ways, and to create friendships. Friendships require time, and not everybody has time because or very few people have time because we're all busily trying to pay for those labor-saving devices. But as we became acclimatized and acculturated to isolating ourselves in the urban setting because we have so many daily contacts that we can't manage them all, we're really only wired, some people say for 120 or 150, we're really only wired for that many people in our immediate community. And if, you know, I don't know where you, you know, you're living in Toronto, downtown Toronto, I mean, you see that many people if you leave your office and go out to buy a cup of coffee and come back, you know. So you need to distance yourself because you just can't handle it. There's a kind of overload. And so one way of handling it evolved in the 60s, which was kind of a very brief sort of recognition and then turning away. But even that, you know, in the modern city can, you know, consume all of your emotional energy for the whole day long. So now, you know, you walk through the streets with earphones in your ears or, you know, staring into an iPhone, at texting someone you're close to. And this isolates you from making these contacts in the city. But those contacts are actually, you know, an opportunity to make friends. And so our opportunities to make friends are reduced. The social skills required to make friends are reduced. And our satisfaction and maybe acculturation to using these devices instead of using friends is increased. So although we often feel a lack, maybe kind of a hole in our lives, we don't know really what's supposed to go in there. And, you know, of course, what's supposed to go in there is lasting, meaningful social relationships, which are not always happy. Friends can be very annoying, but, you know, it's the proximity that counts. You know,
yeah.
I mean, you know, how many times has your best friend pissed you off? With, I don't know, just by saying overly personal things in public or something like that, you know, just
sure.
what friends do, you know, but we've kind of lost our tolerance for that, you know, whereas, you know, he does it three times and then you think, okay, I got to get a new friend. Or, okay, you know, this guy is not what I thought he was, you know, I just, so our, you know, the duration of friendships is greatly reduced. And I think the duration of friendships is reduced, began to become reduced when we lost our relationship to material goods. We don't keep, you know, hoard material goods and reuse them in a variety of different ways. Instead, we, you know, just throw them out, and we do the same thing with people. Why?
Would this be part of, I mean, you're talking a lot, you're talking about, you know, not valuing physical goods, and your previous book was talking a lot about planned obsolescence and just this, between the two of them, there's kind of a general theme of disregarding and throwing away objects. And also in the same sense, you know, it's easier to get rid of this friend or to get rid of this partner because I can just grab another one. Is it all part of the same mindset? Is it all part of just a disposable planet kind of mindset that we're all in?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've systematically shut down our empathy, and also we've shut down our sense of responsibility through time. So, relationships are no longer things to be grown. Material goods are no longer things to be crafted and cherished. You know, things that acquire a patina over time, they're things to be replaced. And I think, you know, the reason we do this is because we've assigned a monetary value to almost everything in our lives, and with that kind of one-dimensional worldview of consumerism, we don't see we don't stop and smell the roses anymore. You know, we don't value a sunset, although we might value it during our commute out of the car window for 5 minutes before we get home, and you know, throw ourselves down on the couch in front of the TV.
We do stop and watch the cat video. We just may not stop for the roses.
And, you know, we've impoverished ourselves, you know, and it's very sad. And other, you know, parts of the world where people are much poorer than us in terms of material goods, they're actually much richer in terms of their personal connections and the satisfaction of the quality of their life, you know. And I find this. I mean, when I returned, I started writing Made the Break when I came back from the Arab world in 2001, and just was really struck by the. I don't know if I can say this on your radio.
If you can't, we'll edit it out.
Oh, okay, good. Well, the sort of "fu" next, you know, or you know, the sort of a complete lack of conversation or exchange while you're, you know, in a retail outlet buying something, and sort of you know, get through this transaction as quickly as possible, supersize it if you can, and then you know, get on to the next one. Whereas, you know, in the Arab world, you're playing a game with a person who's selling you something, you know, even if it's for a few pennies, you know, and you're establishing this kind of clever social connection that carries on into, you know, the next exchange, you know.
So one of the things we've talked about now is we've talked about some of the social disconnectedness. We've talked about how that applies to, you know, old technology, new technology, and sort of this path of increasingly being disconnected towards both people and objects. Yeah. Around us. So what I want to ask you now is okay, so I mean you've got a good example, I think, from a minute ago of just the idea of disposable mentality and just sort of throwing things away and not thinking and not valuing the individual object, but simply in a way almost valuing its function but not its form, in that its form can be replaced. But so what are the actual consequences then, I guess, to that? Or say, okay, I've been convinced, so what?
Oh, well, gee, well, they're massive. You know, I don't know. I don't know whether it's my age or you know, I'm 59, turning 60, and I'm just starting to, you know, reach out for the first time in many years to make new friends and sort of build a community around me and my family, which is, you know, it's possible to do, but it's very time-consuming, and so, you know, you have to change your priorities completely. But also, you know, the consequences are disastrous, not just in a personal term. They're disastrous in terms of our physical well-being and you know, our ability to survive the future. You know, so there is this, I don't think, you know, even the most fundamental people in the United States deny climate change anymore. It's pretty, you know, there are megastorms lashing the coast, and there are, you know, tornadoes coming down many miles north of Tornado Alley in January, you know, and much more powerful tornadoes than have ever existed before. There are all kinds of things happening. The Arctic ice cap is melting, you know, the sea levels are rising much quicker than we have ever experienced before, and you know, I don't know what year the drought in the south west during the United States is, it must be the fifth year of full drought now, but it was very bad last year, and it's going to be even worse this year. And so we've set ourselves on this course in order to, you know, achieve this level of material comfort that's, you know, the basis of consumerism, but that also impoverishes our lives because it eliminates the kind of interpersonal dimension. We've set ourselves on this course where we're actually threatened as a species, and all species are actually threatened. And so it's disastrous and frightening, and we haven't yet woken up to the full implications of it. And I think the full implications are what my next book, American Exodus, will be about in North America as the you know, as climate change ramps up during the coming decade. A lot more Americans will be considering moving into the northern states and then crossing the border into Canada, as Mexicans and Latin Americans have been crossing the border into the United States since maybe about 1982. So the massive migration that has come into the United States from Mexico and Latin America, I think, will have a second stage to it. And Canada will see an explosion in its North American immigrant population very soon.
So just with the last minute or so here to go, I know you've...
Sorry, I ran on at the moment.
No, no, that's fine. we've got you had an opportunity there to talk about your book that's coming up, which is American Exodus. I'm very interested to hopefully get a chance to take a look at it. I'm interested in it hadn't occurred to me the concept of there suddenly being a massive immigration to Canada due to climate change, but I guess it makes a lot of sense. Before we leave everybody here, I like to always try and turn the knob up a little bit right at the end there. We've got some serious issues here, about just the idea about social disconnectedness and everything. And while you were talking, I was thinking about, when we sit and gripe, at least here, with my friends, talking about, there seems like there's all this information about there, the environment's in a terrible state, but there's really, there's stuff we can do about it. Why isn't anybody paying attention? Why isn't anybody doing anything? Maybe they just don't understand. But I think you've revealed another layer there, which is that I think there's a good chance that many, many people are perfectly aware of what's going on. They've just become so socially numb to it. Because it's easier. And I think that's sort of like within the theme of what you're talking about it's, it's easier to have Facebook friends than real ones because they're, not as much access to disappoint you. They don't take as much time to keep, it's just more efficient.
Much easier to get rid of them too.
Sure. the whole process is easier, but I think you've made a good point there that while it is easier, we lose something in the process. And I think we've given some good examples of that. With your newest book that's coming out sort of as a finishing point, I want you just to give us a little bit of hope maybe here at the end so we've identified a problem and I was wondering if you might have identified any solutions. What can we do to start fixing this without, destroying all technology and starting over as a civilization?
Start scrubbing the atmosphere, I think, almost immediately, maybe as of yesterday. Plant a lot more trees that aren't subject to pine beetles. Consider where, the wettest and coolest areas are going to be over the next 10 or 20 years. And then get a really solid estimate of... I think the carbon in the atmosphere is now at 395 parts per million. It needs to be, and it was before the Industrial Revolution, down at 280 parts per million. Some people say it needs to be 340 parts per million. How do we get it back there? How do we stop these carbon producing processes, switch to a different kind of fuel, and which different kinds of fuels are available? And how do we do all this in short order, in a global sense? I mean, we really got to devote ourselves to that.
I'm afraid we are out of time, but Giles Slade, I would want to thank you very much for getting you on the phone today. And of course, if you are coming to us via the Alternatives Journal article, there will, of course, be links to his work up there. If you're coming to us from elsewhere, there will be links on the Green Majority site as well. And once again, just want to thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Dan.
That was Darren Kaster interviewing Giles Slade, author of The Big Disconnect for the AJ podcast. Learn more at alternativesjournal.ca. Here's Janice Lee with White Collar Blues.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Whoa. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You criticize, you gone and sign away your passion and dreams for a cushy salary. Buy a house, grab a spouse, drive a car, go to the bar. When did you fall into the white collar blues? Excuses, who rules and loses? White collar blues and blues and blues. All you do is consume, taking up as much as you can by plundering land, buying new than disposable. goes, hoping it'll decompose.
Would you like all your shits buried with you?
Excuses, who loses, white collar blues, a blues, a blues.
Darren Kaster interviewing Frankie James, artist and author of Band on the Hill, which we have an excerpt of in the latest issue of Alternatives Journal. Find a copy of AJ on a newsstand near you, or learn more by visiting alternativesjournal.ca.
So if you would, maybe we'll just start your choice of two sort of very seemingly disparate interests, one of which being things that are inextricably linked to the to politics. That being things around politics itself, and also having to do with sort of freedom of speech and transparency, and just being a democratic citizen, in a democratic system, and how that relates to your other main interest, which is art. So perhaps you could connect those two dots for us to start.
Okay, I mean, to me, they're totally connected. I think that a good example is a project that I created called Wax PM, and it's an online polling game, nonpartisan, that we created in 2004, 2006, 2008 for the federal election, okay? And what the user could do was they went to the website Wax PM, and you could hit any of the, and you were supposed to hit the one that said the stupidest thing, right? So, you know, it's all subjective. You know, one person wants to hit the NDP, another person wants to hit the Conservatives, another person wants to hit the Green Party, right?
Mm-hmm.
But this is so fun. And the reason it's fun is because it gets people engaged in the issues that matter, the election issues, and how our society is being shaped through these political decisions. So I've just had so much fun over the years in creating entertaining and engaging content on the issues of the day.
So what made you think that that people didn't find this sort of thing interesting? Why did you feel that that you needed to make it interesting for people to want it? Shouldn't people be very interested in their own democracy?
Oh, well, that's a really good question. I think that there's a lot of apathy out there around politics in some ways. Like, people are going to go, oh, I don't want to vote. You know, oh, politicians are all liars. Why do you want to get involved? Why do you even want to think about political issues? But we have to think about them because they really shape our society and the type of candidate that we have.
So if you would follow that through a bit further for me, what do you think the consequences of apathy are? Within the context of politics, as you're saying, what happens? So we have a bunch of people who decide to not to vote. So what?
Right, but I mean, it's so serious. Like, you know, I know that we're all wrapped up in our own, you know, lives, our own busy work, and we don't really want to have to think about what the government is doing about social justice issues, environmental issues. We don't really, like, many of us don't want to think about those things. But the fact is, it's changing the face of Canada, the laws that and the policies that are being put in place. And we just take for granted environmental protections, which unfortunately are disappearing rapidly. The recent conservative budget bills have destroyed decades of environmental protection. So I think that we all need to be aware of how the government can change the rules. And we need to speak up and say, we don't agree with those things. We need everybody on board speaking strongly. And so this goes back to my own decision in 2008. I was very concerned that Harper was going to win the election, and I didn't think his policies were good. So I decided to write a letter, and I called it Dear Prime Minister. And I wrote the letter based on the idea that he was making us choose between the environment and the economy, when really there is no choice. You know, the economy is part of the environment. We have to respect the environment if you're going to have a healthy economy. So anyway, so I wrote this visual letter, which people can see online. It's in my new book, Dear Prime Minister. And the basis of that letter asks Harper to have a carbon tax. And I thought that, you know, it's just everyone's right in Canada to stand up and, you know, and speak about issues like that and ideas like that. But unfortunately, as the past couple of years have shown me, the government doesn't like dissenting voices. They don't want to hear from people like me.
And that's a perfect segue into one of the reasons why you're a bit of a Canadian superstar in that sense. You've gotten some notoriety, but potentially from the wrong people.
Yeah.
Would you like to talk a little bit about now about your experience being blacklisted and the inspiration for some of the content from your Alternatives Journal article and as well as your new book?
Right. So where do I start?
Well, how about start at the letter, the original letter that you saw that inspired the name of the book.
Ah, okay. Well, that letter is called Frankie James is Your Fault. And it's written by a trade commissioner in Berlin, who I subsequently found out is the former ambassador to Croatia. But anyway, so this fellow is writing to a colleague in Croatia. And the subject line of that email is, Frankie James is your fault. And he is blaming the lady that he's writing to, saying, are you the one that connected, you know, the Canadian embassy to an artist with a green conscience? And this is an artist whose work sharply criticizes the men and women working in the oil sands. So I could say more, but the fact is that we actually can't see very much of what Thomas Maher wrote. And the reason is, it's all been blacked out for reasons of international security and conversations with the minister, which is so shocking. I mean, when I show it to people, their mouths drop open, as mine did when I saw this. I went, what the hell is going on? I mean, can you imagine seeing a letter that says, you know, Darren is your fault?
I might not mind the press at this point, but your point is still taken.
I decided that Frankie James is Your Fault was such a crazy title and gave a good example of the censorship that's been going on at the government regarding me, and that should be the title of my book. And so what is the book about? The book is seven of my illustrated essays on politics and the environment, which I've written since 2008. And it's really interesting because, like, in 2008, that was the first time that I ever wrote a letter to, you know, the Prime Minister. And it certainly got noticed. And then in 2011, I was invited to show my art Europe in a traveling exhibition, and that was so exciting. So the people at a small NGO in Croatia, the company is called Nectarine, a nonprofit. They saw my work. They said, "You know what? What can one person do? That is just so inspiring, and we're going to use it to inspire youth to take action to reduce their carbon footprint."
Congratulations.
Right? Yeah, it was really exciting. They said, we want to buy 20 pieces of your art, and that eventually grew to 40 pieces of your art, and you can send them over to us, and we're going to have them travel around all these cities, and eventually it was going to travel to 20 cities in Europe. So, and this was wonderful, and they were buying my work outright, so I didn't see any problem. I was busy getting the art ready to send over, and then we hit a snag. And I could tell that somehow things weren't quite moving ahead. I mean, I was supposed to be shipping the art momentarily, and, you know, things weren't coming together. So what I did was, on May 19th, 2011, I arranged to have a Skype phone call with the director of Nectarina, Sandra Antonovic, and I asked her what was going on. And she said that she didn't think that the show was going to be canceled, but that she had talked to a lady from the, she's talked to the cultural officer from the Canadian Embassy in Croatia, and she found out that the Canadian government didn't like my art at all. And she was warned flat out by Nectarina, or by the Canadian Embassy, not to show my work.
That's a very odd thing for the embassy to even involve themselves in.
I agree. I agree. The problem with the lawsuit is it's extremely expensive to sue the government.
Mm.
And it would take years of my time. So anyway, so I don't know, you know, on the, in terms of, I don't think that it was legal, but it they definitely interfered behind the scenes in a business deal, and it cost me many, many thousands of dollars. So anyway, so when I spoke with Sandra on May 19th, 2011, she told me that she'd met with Vladka at the coffee shop, and Vladka had got wind of, that Ottawa had got wind of the art show, and they said, who's the idiot who approved of an art show by that woman, Frankie Dinn? And like, I go, what is going on? And then Vladka told Sandra not to show my art because this artist speaks against the Canadian government. And I was dumbfounded. I went, how could she possibly say that? What is she talking about? I don't speak against the Canadian government. You know, I'm critical of some of their policies on the environment. You know, but Sandra said that the example given to her was the visual essay that I'd written to Prime Minister in 2008, which asked for a carbon tax. But after hearing this news, Sandra and I decided, well, we're still going to go ahead with the show. You know, who cares about that little $5,000 grant? We're going ahead. And we had some sponsors for the show, so everything was fine. But then I thought, well, I'm a Canadian citizen, right? And I should be able to get some support, at least moral support, from the embassy. So I contacted them through a website called the Virtual Trade Commissioner to ask if I could rent space for a press event, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the Canadian embassies are busy promoting books and authors and art and music and all sorts of things all the time, right? So I thought, well, this is fine. And if I am paying for it, they should be able to do that, right?
Absolutely.
So anyway, so that's when things got really interesting. And I can say that because I've got the internal government documents now which show what was really happening behind the scenes and how they were bad-mouthing. And initially, several of the embassies were interested in helping me, and there was lots of excitement. There was talk of tag-teaming on the show as it traveled to various cities. One even suggested that the ambassador could come to the event because, you know, embassies love to promote cultural art projects. But then an ambassador, Scott Hetherington, heard about my request, and he sent a letter to the trade commissioner in Toronto saying why he wouldn't support me or my show. Unfortunately, we can't read what his reasons are because it's all blacked out for reasons of national security, right?
Mm, yes,
of course. But we can see him telling her to look at my essay, Fat Cat Canada, which is all about the tar sands.
Mm-hmm.
So that letter from Ambassador Hetherington was then sent to scores of other people. And just like nasty gossip, people who had previously indicated they could assist me changed their minds. Just after I contacted the embassies, the sponsors pulled out. And shortly after that, Nectarina issued a public statement saying they'd faced bullying and interference from the Canadian government.
Wow.
So the show was off, and that's when I decided to take action. And I filed access to information requests to get government emails and documents. And I also launched a crowdfunding campaign to raise money for a street ad poster show in Ottawa around the corner from the Parliament building. So this was like just so much fun, mm-hmm. right? In November 2011, I had my show, which I called Band on the Hill. It was a big success. It got lots of press. And thankfully, the access to information documents, which I'd applied for, came through 2 days before the show went live. And that initial bunch of documents that came through, I think I got 165 pages, that initial bunch of documents showed that the government had actually approved a grant, a small grant of $5,000 to Nectarina, but then it had been pulled, it had been withdrawn because I advocated against government policy.
Again, I have no legal expertise or background or anything like that, but I'm just as a citizen hearing your story, there's so many points in this where I'm just thinking to myself, like, can they do that? Is that, you know, is that,
I know.
I don't know if like legal is maybe the wrong word. I'm not implying that it's necessarily like criminal behavior, but it should be like against policy or against the rules
I
mean, if it isn't, it should be. I'm really having a hard time understanding how,
you know,
this, any of this even happened.
I feel the same way. The thing is that, in my, public statements, and then you can see it in the access documents, too, where I challenge them and I say, you know, you are going against my charter rights to freedom of expression. And, I should be allowed to speak up. You don't have to agree with what I'm saying, but I should be allowed to speak up and not get the government interfering behind the scenes. This is awful. You know, this is like just so important. And that's why I've got this book coming out. And I want the average Canadian to really take notice of it, because what happened to me could happen to, you know, your sister, your aunt, your neighbor, right? It's like we cannot be afraid of speaking up in Canada. If people look at my art, they're going to say, you know, they'll see that, you know, I'm putting out my opinion that I think that we should have a carbon tax or we should take certain action to protect the environment. This stuff isn't, it just seems common sense to me. And definitely within the limits of good civil discourse and freedom of speech. And this is protected by the Charter of Rights. So I will be pushing forward on that.
So within the idea of the cartoons, I mean, we've spoken a lot about some of your story and where this is where this has come from, where some of the inspiration has come from through simply the attempt of trying to do your art has caused almost more projects for you by your reaction and what's happened to you as a result of them have inspired further action on your behalf. So I think it's a very commendable to do that.
This is so much fun, okay? The thing is that, I mean, when they secretly whacked me down behind the scenes, were bad-mouthing me, they probably never thought of how I would react, right? And I wasn't supposed to ever find out. Thank goodness it's because of the honesty of Nectarina that I heard what was going on, and then I decided to dig deeper, and I've ended up with 2,000 pages of access documents.
And we should note for listeners as well as a sideline that on your website you do have some information there about how to about your process about how you learned to go and access and read access to information requests as well.
Right, and there's actually going to be more tips in my book, which will be helpful for anybody who wants to apply for access to information documents and actually analyze them, because I've learned a lot. But this whole process has been really, really fascinating, because before this, I was never concerned about censorship or free speech. I just took it for granted. I really did. You know, I thought everybody was allowed to speak up in Canada, right? But it's only through this experience that I've learned that the government really doesn't like dissenting voices, and they will go to extreme lengths to shut people up and to interfere. And this is just so wrong, and this should not be happening.
I recently saw, speaking of artwork, a picture of a Canadian flag being passed around, except in the lower right corner it said something about it being a subsidiary of Exxon.
That's right. But you know what? The thing is that if people go to my site, they can actually read a piece that I wrote putting forward the idea of how to develop the oil sands in a more environmentally conscious way. And that idea is to pick up on the forest stewardship model and use consensus decision-making. But it would mean bringing, you know, the stakeholders together and really agreeing in a very fair way. And so it may not happen in the near future, but I am putting positive suggestions forward.
So I'm afraid we're almost out of time, and you've given us a wonderful story about your journey. Hopefully people have been directed to this interview, having had an opportunity to look at some of your work. And if they haven't, I hope and I'm sure this has inspired them to go and take a look. But my last question for you before we run out of time, it just has to do with that model, with the art model. We talked a little bit earlier about your choice of connecting art and politics, but specifically, and I'm sure this isn't local just to Canada, but is applicable generally, but there's always been a proud history within politics of political satire. I'm sure it's as old as politics itself. People have been making fun of politicians. But I think a lot of the time when people think of political humor or political cartoons, they think about things that are maybe done from a specific paper that has a certain, you know, leaning of their readership. And so there are liberal leaning papers that may put out things that are cartoons, political cartoons that are critical of conservatives and vice versa. Do you consider yourself within that as far as a sort of a partisan artist? What's different between your work and what we see in the Sunday newspaper?
Oh, well, that's a really interesting question. So the thing is that I think that art and activism go so well together, because it's almost like we're ad agencies for the planet. And the type of art that I'm making isn't really political cartooning. It is about believing in a certain cause and putting my ideas forward in a visual and written way.
And so how the effect of that then on Canadians is, how do you think people generally interact with this material? I mean, you've obviously had a lot of opportunity to speak to people.
Here's a fantastic example. Mm-hmm. Okay, and it's just recent. In 2012, I wrote a story called What is Harper Afraid Of? And it was about the Northern Gateway Pipeline. And it's also about my face-to-face meeting with Minister Joe Oliver, who called environmentalists radicals. And is a really fun story. It's in my book. People can read it. They can also see it online. And that story, the call to action at the end of it, is for people to send a letter to the Prime Minister and also to their local MPs if they're concerned. And they can modify the letter however they want. And almost 8,000 letters have been sent now from my story. So I am so thrilled that my art is inspiring action of that sort on a really important issue of the day.
Thanks for listening to the AJ Podcast. That was Darren Kaster interviewing Frankie James about her new book, Band on the Hill. Check out an excerpt from that book, an essay called Frankie James is Your Fault, in the Art and Media issue of the magazine, which is on newsstands now. And visit us online at alternativesjournal.ca. This podcast has featured music from two Kitchener-Waterloo musicians, Richard Garvey and Janice Lee. If you like their stuff, you can visit them online at richardgarvey.ca and janicejolee.ca. That's Janice, J-O-L-E-E.ca. And catch them on tour across Canada this summer. Here's Richard Garvey with Save the Arts, Cut the War.
Each child paints with creative innocence. This unjust loss, when we send them out to fight, till nobody finger paints anymore. Save the arts, cut the war. Save the arts, cut the war. Each child sings joyful songs until we silence them, forget those melodies, no more harmonies anymore. Save the arts, cut the war. Save the arts, cut the war. Child dances, freely moving, until we sit them down, operate like machinery, till nobody dances anymore. Save the arts, cut the war. masterpiece, go to the ballet or the symphony. Save the arts, cut the war. Save the arts, cut the war.